Welcome to Theodisc, the WTC Theology podcast. I'm your host, Kenny Innes, and this is episode 34. Are there signs in the West that attitudes towards God and faith are shifting? That's a hope presented by our guest for this episode, Justin Brierley. Justin has been hosting and leading conversations for some time around Christian apologetics, interfaith dialogue, theological debate, and the place of Christianity within Western culture. You can find out about all of Justin's work at justinbrierley.com, but for this episode, I wanted to speak to him in particular about his latest book and accompanying podcast called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. You may have also seen Justin's recent piece in The Spectator magazine titled A Christian Revival is Underway in Britain, and we'll post links in the show notes. Justin contends that there's a developing shift in Western culture towards an openness to faith in God, accompanied by voices both secular and Christian who are asking new, or perhaps old, questions in the wake of a foundational fracturing of a purely atheistic materialist worldview. As if on cue, shortly after we recorded this interview, Richard Dawkins, that famous biologist and atheist provocateur, suggested that he was quite happy to be a cultural Christian, despite his insistence he could never believe in the claims of Christianity. Is this one more sign of the shift? Well, I hope you enjoy this conversation where Justin unpacks his observations and suggests ways the church can effectively engage this opportunity to communicate the truth of Jesus. If you have any thoughts of your own you'd like to add, we'd love to hear them at podcast@wtctheology.org.uk. Now, here's Justin Brierley on the surprising rebirth of belief in God. Justin Brierley, it's an honor to have you on the Theodisc podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, and we're going to have a conversation today really around this new book that you've brought out called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. But before we get to diving into that, we want to get to know you a little bit more. So three questions that I ask all my first time guests, and these are around things that are constants in your life, things that you return to. So the first category is a book that you return to. You can't use the Bible, so anything other than that.
Yeah, it's probably a bit of a cliche, but it would be the Narnia stories, actually. And that's partly just because I've sort of read them to all of my children. I've got four children, so I kind of have gone through them several times over the years as they've been growing up. And so there's something very nostalgic, because I obviously read them when I was a kid and had them read to me, but even as an adult, there's always sort of I see something fresh, you know, in the pages. Mm-hmm. So obviously The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe being the first one I would normally start with, but then all of them kind of have their special place.
That's great. The new Netflix Narnia series, nervous or excited?
Inevitably a bit nervous, you know. What will it do? Will it get the same reception that the Rings of Power got from J.R.R. Tolkien fans? But we'll see. Is it Greta Gerwig who's in charge of it?
It is, yeah, it is.
Hopefully she'll do a good job. We'll see.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Brilliant. Okay, and then a food or a meal that you return to?
Quite boring in a way, but I really like lasagna.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's just something about, again, probably goes back to it being cooked when I was a kid and it just being a favorite meal, and then there's something about the act of just slicing up this communal, you know, big thing of lasagna between the family. And it's something I can cook. Yeah. You know, I'm reasonably decent at making lasagna, so not that I'm particularly Italian sort of focused or influenced, but if there's one meal I'll kind of return to as a sort of staple, that's the one.
I do like the crunchy bits around the edge of a lasagna. That's the
oh yeah, you got to have the corner bit with all the nice blackened crunchy bit. Absolutely,
that's it. And then finally, a place or a location that you return to?
Well, Swanage in Dorset is a beautiful seaside town. It's where my wife comes from.
Okay.
And where her parents still live and a lot of her extended family. And I just have so many good memories, you know, from when I met my wife. We got married there at her church in Swanage. And and lots of holiday occasions with the kids there and that kind of thing. So that's kind of, yeah, a lovely place to revisit, go back. It sort of never changes much, which is nice, you know. It's and there's a sort of just a nice sort of simple thing. It's it feels like you've kind of got to the end of the country as well. It's like one road in, one road out, so it feels like you know, it's just a little bit of a oasis from the rest of the world.
It's funny, the theologians that I speak to or authors that I speak to, a large percentage always identify somewhere by the sea that is a location that they like to go to.
I think we're all drawn to the sea, aren't we?
Yeah.
At some level, there's something about that wide open space that we like.
That's it. Yeah. Which is a great segue into beginning to talk about your book. And really the beginning of your book, you use this poem from Matthew Arnold. I'm just going to read it here. It says, "The sea of faith was once too at the full and round earth's shore, lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar." And this sense of faith being kind of a tide that is moving outwards. And you describe a conversation with Douglas Murray where he talks about that, sure, tides go out, but tides also return. And it feels like a little bit of what you're doing in this book is being someone who's standing on the seawall pointing to a tide coming back in.
Douglas Murray, listeners may be familiar with the name, but he's a sort of agnostic sort of political thinker, writer, associate editor of The Spectator, you know, has quite strong kind of political takes and so on. But he's an interesting character because I've had him on in conversations a few times with Christians, because he describes himself as a Christian atheist, someone who I think was very influenced by the new atheism in his early 20s and kind of lost whatever faith he did have under the influence of people like Christopher Hitchens, who he was a regular, you know, lunch partner with and so on. But I think came to realize in more recent years that actually atheism per se doesn't buy you a kind of a set of morals, basically. And he realized that really the main influence on the things he took for granted, you know, as a Westerner, was, you know, his belief in freedom, human rights, equality, dignity, so on. They really came from Christianity. So when I had him in a conversation with N.T. Wright a few years ago, he referenced this well-worn phrase from Matthew Arnold's poem about the melancholy, long, withdrawing roar of the sea of faith, and said, but the thing about the sea of faith is it could come back in again. That's the point of tides. And it was in the context of him talking about some interesting conversions that he'd seen among some of his secular peers, people who were, you know, intelligent, rational people who had, for whatever reason, found the Christian story made sense. And so he wondered whether there might be an opportunity just happening in this moment for the church to speak into, as he called it, a more receptive crowd. And that was a catalyst for me thinking about this book. I'd noticed myself a real change in the atmosphere on the conversation around God, from the years, you know, when I started The Unbelievable Show, these very bombastic, dogmatic debates between new atheist types and Christian thinkers, to these much more kind of nuanced, not necessarily believers, but people who were much more open to the value of Christianity, people like Douglas Murray, and I'm sure we'll come to name some others like Tom Holland and others. But I was also seeing some surprising converts as well, like Murray. Now that doesn't mean, you know, there's a flood of people coming into the churches, but there were enough sort of interesting stories to make me think maybe there's something happening. And if it is the tide coming back in, it's certainly not coming in at full strength at this point by any stretch of the imagination. But we might be just at the point, I wondered, of the turning of that tide, that it's kind of the secular thing has reached its furthest ebb, if you like. And we're maybe just starting to see the first signs that the tide is beginning to turn. So that's the image that kind of I use on the front of the book, a kind of tide coming in, and use throughout the book and this new podcast documentary series. But I have really Douglas Murray to thank for it. Yeah.
I remember listening to Unbelievable over the years, and I think in the earlier days you certainly did get that sense at the end of a conversation. Has anybody really moved in their position? You know, you sometimes would get that. But then as it progressed, you're right, there did seem to be this, there was a hosting of a conversation that was beyond just the two people in the room. There seemed to be movement that was happening.
I think that's a really good way of putting it as well, though, that very rarely in any specific 1 hour conversation would, you know, one side or the other really change their mind. They might kind of, you know, go away and think about things differently. But I would say, yeah, if you listened to that show over the, you know, I was hosting it for 17 plus years, there was definitely a kind of a change in the overall tone, you know, of where people were coming from. And even some people, you know, at the beginning of that journey, if I looked at them 15 years later, they might not be able to, you know, pinpoint any particular conversation, but they definitely changed where they were, where they stood. They weren't nearly as, say, antagonistic towards Christianity. They maybe had come to realize that the atheist kind of community wasn't, you know, some sort of paragon of, you know, virtue and communal yeah. life or anything. So there were definitely journeys that I saw people go on, even if you only saw that kind of them in that moment on the show, you know, yeah. as they came in.
So the new atheism has made quite a large impact, I think, culturally. People were aware of people like Hitchens and Dawkins and others. And I think sometimes in the church, we are a little bit behind the cultural progress or where the conversation's at. And I think for people who weren't listening in on that conversation, could we just have a quick overview of what happened with the new atheist movement, both in how it arose and your description of it seems to be like a shipwrecking of that movement.
Yeah, I think, you know, very briefly, new atheism was this very sort of dogmatic, quite public form of atheism, led arguably by these four characters, the so-called four horsemen of the new atheism, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and Daniel Dennett, each with their own sort of best-selling anti-God book. Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, probably being the most well-known of them. And they were often on TV, on op-eds, you know. There were atheist conferences happening that they were speaking at, being treated as sort of these intellectual rock stars, really, by lots of people in the secular world. And it kind of came on the heels, I think, of 9/11 and a sort of general feeling that was in the air that maybe religion's bad for us. And we, you know, and there were certain sort of cultural debates going on around the teaching of intelligent design in the classroom, especially in the USA, that were kind of engendering a certain sort of antipathy towards religion generally in a large part of the US. And that, with the kind of birth of the internet and the fact people were finding each other who perhaps, you know, were more spread out before, but able to get together in chat rooms and form these communities, it led to this sort of, yeah, this new atheism sort of coming up. And it was a very dismissive kind of form of atheism. It wasn't particularly a terribly intellectually kind of grounded one. It was much more about memes and ridicule. So, you know, at the Reason Rally in 2011, I want to say, you know, when Richard Dawkins was on the stage, he was there to sort of champion science and reason, but he also was there to say, you know, when you see religion, ridicule it, you know, make fun of it and so on. And so I think it was very much about sort of rallying people in that way. Probably the most obvious example of it in the UK was the Atheist Bus campaign in sort of 2009, red London buses bearing the slogan, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." So it was just it was just this very kind of open and big sort of demonstration of atheism as an option for people, encouraging, you know, quite an evangelistic form of atheism. But yes, it did sort of seem to disappear almost as quickly as it arose. I think the bubble burst to some extent on the atheist book genre. I think a lot of people just moved on, as people do in culture. I think to some extent, they didn't really answer that many of the deeper existential questions people had. It kind of tapped into a lot of people's dissatisfaction with things they didn't like about religion, but didn't go much beyond that. And the problem was, I think, that once they'd agreed that God didn't exist and religion was bad for you, the atheist community itself couldn't agree on much else beyond that, because they quickly splintered and fractured actually in the latter sort of part of the movement. So there was a sort of one particular example, which I think was quite significant in 2012, when Rebecca Watson, who was quite a popular atheist vlogger, who was, you know, representing kind of feminism and critiquing some of the misogyny and sexism in the atheist movement. She was at an atheist conference in Dublin, speaking alongside people like Richard Dawkins. And after sort of doing her session where she talked about the problems with sexism in the atheist movement, she ended up getting propositioned basically in an elevator on the way back to her hotel room by a member of one of the audience, and she wrote a, you know, she did a piece saying, look, this is the problem, you know, and that might have been the end of it, except that Richard Dawkins sort of chimed in and wrote a heavily sarcastic blog called Dear Muslima, in which he, you know, sarcastically compared her woes being asked back to someone's room for coffee to say a Muslim woman, you know, having her hand chopped off because she's not doing what her husband tells her, and says, but, you know, pity my poor American sisters who have, you know, being asked for coffee in an elevator. Anyway, this came to be dubbed Elevatorgate, as anything does that's mm-hmm. controversial gets the suffix gate. And it was just a moment when the atheist community kind of split, because there were people who wanted it to go in this very socially justice oriented conscious movement, sort of, you know, that was more than just about atheism. Atheism plus wanted to be about, you know, LGBT rights, feminism, and so on. And others who were kind of on the Richard Dawkins side of this, who thought this is just all political correctness. We don't need this in our common sense movement. Mm. And really from that point on, the movement just began to splinter and splinter. And the fights between the atheists were far worse than anything that happened between the Christians, to the point where these conferences were actually being cancelled because the atheists, you know, the well-known atheists were unwilling to share a stage with each other because they'd fallen out with each other so dramatically. So that was kind of interesting to watch from the sidelines, the way the movement itself just couldn't hold itself together. Mm-hmm. Once it got up to a certain point, suddenly it all just seemed to fall apart quite quickly. And now, you know, obviously it's not that all those key characters have become Christians or believers, but they're certainly really not spending their time critiquing institutional religion much any longer. They're, most of them have moved into kind of one side or the other on the culture wars, you know, so like the Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, you know, they're on the sort of anti-woke side, and the Rebecca Watsons and Matt Dillahunty's, they've kind of gone onto the, you know, very pro-social justice side and that kind of thing. So it's interesting to see the way they may have had this one thing in common, this kind of belief that religion's bad for you and God doesn't exist, but their actual ethics and their actual way of what happens next was completely different, it turned out. And that just blew the movement apart in a way.
Nevertheless, there seems to still be an echo of the impact that they made on the culture, this kind of sense of whether it's anti-religion or we don't need religion anymore.
Mm.
It feels kind of like leading people to the edge of a cliff and then not providing them the bridge to get to the other side.
Mm.
There seems to be this real lack of meaning in what they were presenting, the inability to find a meaning that undergirds life.
Yeah, because I think what they did was they you know, tore God down,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't erect anything in God's place, because science and reason, if you try and put that in God's place, it's just not up to the task. You know, it's good for some things, but it's not good for building a moral framework for leading a flourishing life. You have to go somewhere else for those things. And I think what more and more people have realized, you know, the Douglas Murrays and so on are realizing, is that actually when it comes to the actual ethics that the secular humanists embody, that they don't come from atheism. They don't come from science. They don't come from the Enlightenment. It's fairly hard to, it's not that difficult to see that they actually do come from Christianity in the end.
Yep.
And so I think there's been a kind of increasing realization that, oh, hang on, you know, it turns out that basically we're sort of Christian atheists, you know, that is what I'm hearing a lot more of them saying. And just the realization that, you can call it what you like secular humanism, whatever, but at the bottom of it, there's still a faith element. There's still a kind of, it's something that you can't prove from science or pure reason about the way we should treat each other, about what's important in life, about what we should, you know, treat as sacred and so on. So all of that's been interesting to see that's the realization of that has just come more and more to the fore. And I don't think necessarily through any kind of great philosophical introspection, more just because as people saw the movement collapse and people falling out, and the fact that the more science and technology we have, it turns out that's not the answer. We can't save ourselves. I think people are just almost, you know, at an experiential level being turned back to the possibility that there might be more, that Christianity has something to offer, that even that, you know, there might be some sort of transcendent sort of aspect to the universe. So that's what I've been fascinated to kind of, start to chronicle as the movement has changed.
Yeah, it's like maybe a growing awareness of the water that we're all swimming in. And in the book, you walk through several spheres where there seems to be a renewed search for meaning and talk about the writings and interactions with specific figures that seem to be at the forefront of that renewed search. So I thought maybe we could begin by looking a little bit about how the historical record of Christianity is being reassessed through people like Tom Holland and others who are looking at maybe the story is not that Christianity stopped the progress of society. Maybe there's another story there.
Yeah. And I was fortunate to just, at the time of recording, at least just last week, have a live conversation in London with Tom Holland, who's a fascinating character. I'm sure many listeners are familiar with him as a historian who co-hosts probably one of the best listened to podcasts in the world, The Rest Is History. He's a very successful author of historical, you know, works. And his story, though, in brief, is that he sort of, whatever childhood faith he had, had fizzled out by his teenage years. And he was a sort of very happy, sort of secular humanist kind of person after university. But it was his experience of researching and living in the sandals of the Greeks and the Romans for his work that made him realize just how alien their way of life and their values were to his own. And, you know, the way that, you know, in the Greco-Roman world, slavery was just a completely assumed part of the culture and the, you know, the way things ran, that, you know, a Roman male could have sex with anyone who is essentially his social inferior. There's no concept of consent. You know, lifelong monogamous matrimony, you know, just was quite unusual in the pagan world. The way that, you know, the lives of women and children were far more cheap, and lots of different things, you know, the essential way people thought about power and victims was just completely inverted, he realized, not by science or the Enlightenment or anything like that. It was the Christian Revolution that completely changed the way we think about those. So all of our absolute assumptions about, you know, human rights, dignity, equality, compassion for the poor, looking out for the most vulnerable in our culture, none of that existed essentially before Christianity. And he just went on this personal intellectual journey, which he's now brought a lot of other people along as he's written books like Dominion and talked at length in various settings about this. And I think just reminding his secular peers, even not as necessarily a Christian himself, but simply reminding them that their fundamental instincts are actually Christian. And I think maybe that becoming more and more apparent in a world where the Western sort of ideal is being questioned, you know, where you are seeing more other worldviews coming into force, where the ability of China to influence, you know, the world is growing all the time, where Putin can invade another country, where there is still, you know, a real threat in parts of the world from fundamentalist Islam. There are lots of other worldviews on the table that have been quite successful, actually. Mm-hmm. So what privilege is our one over their vision of life? And I think Tom is just reminding people that this is a sort of very, don't assume this is just what any civilized society comes up with. It's very rare. It's cultivated in this very unique soil of the Christian Revolution. And I found that really helpful, because he's almost like a prophet from outside the church, reminding everyone what the Christian Revolution did for them. And yeah, and I guess sort of asking, well, do we want to hold on to this? You know, how do we, if we're going to? I suppose that's my bit of the thing. I think Tom's done a lot of this amazing work reminding us of our roots, and I've come along to try and sort of ask, what do we do about this now? How do we help people if they are starting to feel like, hang on, yeah, how do I make sense of my belief in human rights? Is that going to continue to be the dominant way we think about humans in a increasingly technological world, in an AI saturated world, in a world where there are these other options on the table? And I just think it's an interesting moment for the church to be able to sort of remind people basically of, as you say, the waters they swim in, and whether there's, and what it takes for that to be true, if it is true, you know.
And along with that reassessment then of the history of Christianity and its effects, there's also seems to be this reassessment of the Bible, not as just a primitive document that we can dismiss, but actually something that carries moral weight and meaning when you look at it.
Absolutely. And again, I'm hearing more and more secular intellectuals, not people who would think of themselves as Christians necessarily, talking in these ways. So Jonathan Haidt is a psychologist who, again, has written books like The Happiness Hypothesis and The Righteous Mind, where he explicitly sort of does something very different to the new atheist. Instead of dismissing religion as this virus of the mind, he says, actually, there's a reason why these writings have survived. There's the kind of, you know, and he might be doing it from a purely kind of material psychological sort of perspective, you know, there's an evolutionary sort of reason, but he's still saying there is a value to these things. There's a reason why this wisdom has persisted and why societies and people organize themselves in this way around these transcendent ideals. It's because actually it turns out we do far better when we do that. And so I think it's interesting to hear people, even at a purely secular level, kind of talking about the value of tradition, wisdom, the Bible. Obviously, someone who'd been doing this a lot with big audiences, Jordan Peterson, and he features quite a bit in the book and the podcast, as someone who's almost, you know, come in and is speaking to a lot of the same demographic as those new atheists were. But suddenly he seems to be talking to a lot of disaffected young men, especially, who feel like, you know, the promises of this secular utopia aren't working out. Yeah. And they're asking, well, is there something in that fuddy-duddy old book that might have something to say to me? And Jordan Peterson appears to be saying, yes, there is. It's packed with all this incredible, deep psychological insight. Now, where he lands up on the question of, is it really true? That's an interesting question, and one we kind of, you know, we're exploring in this podcast series. But he's certainly pointing people back to the value of it, and to the deep patterns of meaning and symbolism and everything else. I want to say yes to all of that. I just don't think you should stop there necessarily. I think the reason it works is because it's true, actually. Those are the kinds of conversations I'm interested in teasing out, because I think there has been this real change in the atmosphere. I like, it would have been hard to imagine 10 or 15 years ago, at the height of the new atheism, you know, I sat with about 13,000 people at the O2 watching Jordan Peterson for a couple of hours when he was in the UK recently, basically talk about the Bible and meaning and God. And it would have been hard to imagine that happening, as I say, 10 or 15 years ago at the height of the new atheism. So it feels like something's changed in the atmosphere in that way.
Yeah. And then maybe the last sphere we can look at quickly is the reassessment of the scientific method to bring about a concept of meaning. And that many who proclaim the virtues of science, of which there are many, have arrived at a place of determinism, their own kind of predestination, as a sense, where everything that you do is just kind of predetermined by your biology.
Yeah, I mean, this is the area that probably I end up talking about the least, because it's the most philosophically kind of challenging in some respects. But I'm glad you've raised it, because it kind of forms a lot of chapter 6 of the book, where I talk about the fact that the academy and the new atheists especially have really bought in heavily to this idea that we do live in this completely deterministic universe, that a universe of pure cause and effect, where essentially it's a clockwork universe, and everything you say, think, or do is essentially, you don't really have any agency over. There's not really a you to have any agency over. There's just a kind of a set of chemical and electrical processes going on in this complex thing we call a brain, but it's nothing more than that. And in the end, however much we like to think that, you know, we're choosing our own bowl of cereal in the morning, or deciding how, you know, the person we want to marry, it's none of that's actually decided. It's all a you know, this physical chain of cause and effect. And so this deterministic sort of way of looking at life, I think, although most people kind of don't function like that in reality, because we can't, you know, we have to believe, it's sort of that this story has kind of seeped quite deep. You see it actually in some interesting sci-fi stuff. A lot of sci-fi stuff kind of you know, is based on this idea of us living in this purely, completely deterministic universe. But just in the way I think a lot of people at a psychological level feel like they've lost control of their life. They feel like a cog in a machine, basically. I think it comes through in all kinds of different ways. And I think it's part of, I think that sort of way of looking at life, the machine way of looking at life, the way that essentially we are just a product of, you know, a set of circumstances, our biology and so on. It has contributed to what psychologists have called the meaning crisis, this idea that we're essentially dislocated, we're atomized, we're kind of there's relationships don't really exist, goodness, truth, beauty, justice, they're all just illusions. And I think people are struggling with that, because I think that's a story that's very hard to live in reality. And I think we were made to live actually in a different story of reality. And I just think determinism is false. I think it's false for all kinds of reasons. I think it's self-defeating, ultimately. I think there's a bit of complex philosophical road you can go down there. But I just think the actual concept is ultimately doesn't make sense. You're soaring off the branch you're sitting on if you claim that even your very belief in determinism is itself determined. It's very difficult to see how that works in any kind of rational way. But more than that, I think it's the effects in our culture that we're seeing of that thinking kind of at a low level. It's I think it's very destructive. And that's why I think we are seeing this kind of push against it, both at an academic level. There's a lot of people now really pushing against that deterministic scientistic way of thinking that the new atheists are so keen on. But I'm also seeing it, you know, just generally, you know, at a public conversational level, people say, no, I think there must be something more. There must be some kind of, they might not call it God, but I think it's evidenced in the interest in, you know, psychedelics, in transcendent experiences, in mindfulness. You know, people want there to be some sense in which we can tap into something beyond just our own sort of, you know, chemicals and atoms and so on. So I think there's opportunities for the church to speak into a kind of a dawning awareness that we need more than this purely deterministic way of looking at life.
Just as we kind of finish up here, I think it would be good to think about what we do about this. And really, you know, you end the book with some questions for the reader. A lot of the people who listen to this podcast are theologians or people who are training in theology, who are thinking about communicating truth in the communities where they live and work and worship. And what would you say to them about this need to engage a culture that's searching for meaning, really, that only the Christian story can provide?
I think it's really important to be looking at and understanding why some of these secular thinkers are drawing such large crowds. Why, you may not agree with everything Jordan Peterson writes on Twitter, nor do I, but he is drawing huge crowds of young men to his message. And, you know, and which, what preacher wouldn't love to have, you know, 2,000 people turn up to hear them talk about Genesis for 2 hours? And yet it happens for Jordan Peterson. So I think why is that? What's the attraction? And I think we need to understand that people are still hungry, actually. We sometimes think, oh, people aren't interested in religion anymore. I think people are still very religious deep down. I think they're just kind of religious about different things. The question is, how do we engage people who are kind of running out of energy in that space? And I think the culture wars and the way people are living now, I think that a lot of people are in a kind of low level fight or flight sense. And I think there's a real kind of exhaustion, actually, especially among young people. I think this is partly what's fueling the mental health crisis and so on. And I think the church just needs to be really ready to speak into that and respond to those kinds of questions. Because I think the new atheism is a bit of a past thing. Now, there's going to be people who still have questions about how do I make sense of God, give me an argument for the resurrection or whatever. But I think ultimately, you know, people are really looking for a reason to get out of bed in the morning, a way to make sense of life. And I think what I take from some of those secular thinkers is that people are looking for a story to make sense of their life. And the church, I still think, has the best story going. It's the story that has engaged people for generations, given a sense of purpose and meaning. It's the story which has essentially shaped our moral imagination and still is bubbling away under the surface there. It's the story that people still revert to, even, you know, in moments of great national grief, like the loss of the Queen or something like that. It seems to suddenly bubble up again. And I just think the church should lean into that. I think one of the great mistakes, and I think Tom Holland has pointed this out several times himself, is when the church tries to just accommodate itself to the culture so much that it just looks indistinguishable and just is another sort of mouthpiece of, you know, sort of the civil service or whatever is the current thing that people are talking about. And I think there's something about inviting people into a story that is mysterious, challenging, different, that actually still holds great appeal for people today. And most of the people who I have met, some of these secular intellectuals who have crossed the line to faith, is because they've found something different, something weird about Christianity. And so I think in that sense, it's about keeping Christianity weird, telling our story better, engaging those sort of deeper kind of longings and religious sense that people still have, but showing people that there's a better story. And that's got to be done in all kinds of ways, not just through traditional apologetics, which has been more my field, but through the arts and through our storytelling and through the community of the church and the way we can show what that story looks like in a culture where I think even personal interaction is becoming more and more rare as we live in an increasingly digital world. So I think there's all kinds of ways we can learn from some of these folk who are speaking, seem to be drawing these crowds, and we can be, I just want to inject a note of hope, I suppose, that actually, you know, we hear a lot of bad news about the church. We look at the statistics of decline and we might be tempted to think, oh, the new atheists were right, you know, it's all going to end, you know, but I just, the history isn't like that. And the history of the church is one of lots of death and rebirth, basically. And I just wonder if we're in one of those moments. And so I just hope that it's a hopeful moment, but the church does need to transcend the culture wars, not kind of basically just play by the rules of the game, whether they're on the left or the right, and point people back to this beautiful story that I think is still absolutely captivating, and which I still, you know, see very surprising stories of people suddenly finding make sense of their world again. So that's all very general, probably, you know, but it's going to look different for each individual, but that would be my advice.
Well, thank you, Justin. I really do recommend people pick up a copy of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. It's really well written, it's thought-provoking, and you took the word out of my mouth. I think it really strikes a note of hope for those of us who are looking to engage our world with the story of Jesus. So thank you for coming on and sharing with us. It's a real privilege to have you.
It's lovely to be with you. The other way you can engage the book as well is there's a new podcast documentary series. So if you're a podcast listener, just look for The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God and you'll find the very long version there as well. But yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Justin.
Well, thank you, Justin and Kenny, for how you are making waves in the faith community by showing that even in people of unfaith, there is a profound move of God's Spirit happening. We can't wait to see what the coming tide will bring. In our next episode, Kenny is joined by the wonderful Amy Brown Hughes, who teaches a module called Persecution to Empire, Theology, Culture and Politics in Early Christianity at WTC on our Master's programme. She researches topics like Christian asceticism, theological anthropology, and highlights the contributions of minority voices to theology, especially those of women, which has led her to look at the concept of virginity and how this has a rich and complex theological tradition in Christianity. It promises to be a great episode. Theodisc is part of WTC, a theological college that seeks to partner with the church through equipping and sending the whole people of God. Our innovative hub model allows you to study on any of our part-time programs without leaving your work or ministry. Come and find out more at wtctheology.org.uk. Thank you for listening to episode 34 of Theodisc. Join us for episode 35 with Amy Brown Hughes as we discuss the theological significance of virginity. Bye for now.